Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The news from Najaf has a numbing sameness. For the past 2 weeks, Shiite fighters loyal to the upstart cleric Muqtada al-Sadr have held the revered Imam Ali shrine. Iraqi politicians in Baghdad want them to leave. Meanwhile, American soldiers and helicopter gunships continue to fire on their positions around the mosque. And so it goes. But what if this latest shootout in the war in Iraq is something else? What if it's not really just another encounter between Americans and Iraqis, but in fact the first battle in a new war, a war between Iraq and Iran? There are a number of observers and scholars who believe that Iran is playing a much greater role in the fight in Najaf. Well, do you buy the argument that politicians and clerics in Tehran are helping mastermind the insurgency in Najaf? Or do you think that the stalemate at the mosque is really just a battle between two men, Muqtada al-Sadr and the interim Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Allawi, and the ideals of Iraqi nationalism, Islamism, or American-style democracy? What's your interpretation of the standoff at the Imam Ali Shrine? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start today by getting the latest news from Scott Baldoff. He's a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, and he's joining us on the line from Baghdad. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
We hear that. I know that you were in Najaf for the better part of last week, and we're hearing that the fighting simply continues there despite all the talk. What do you know?
Well, the latest reports we're getting is that there has been somewhat of an artillery between the U.S. and forces of Muqtada al-Sadr near the shrine. Some artillery blasts are coming close to the walls of the shrine itself in the old city. And, of course, there's been plenty of firing coming from the fighters around the shrine, most of it mortar fire aimed at the American forces in the outskirts of the old city. There were also have been reports of helicopters and jet fighters late last night in the old city. As you said earlier, this is something that we've been seeing now for, we're going into the second week of it. There seems to be no true resolution coming, and yet we keep hearing about negotiations and talks going on between intermediaries of Muqtada al-Sadr and representatives of the Iraqi government of Iyad Allawi.
Now, Scott, I mentioned earlier that you're in Baghdad. More specifically, you're in Sadr City, which is the Shiite suburb of Baghdad, which has been home to Muqtada al-Sadr. I'm interested in knowing whether or not that is also a flashpoint in this particular encounter, whether or not there's a danger that there'll be more fighting or continued fighting in Sadr City as Najaf continues to burn.
Well, frankly, the battle here is also fairly constant and has been since this whole fighting has begun. It's maybe not every single day, but just yesterday, forces of Muqtada al-Sadr say that they were able to shoot down a helicopter. A couple days before that, they have video of tanks and Bradley fighters that they had managed to disable here in the streets of Sadr City. So the fighting does continue here and throughout the Shiite south in places like Basra, Nasiriyah, Kufa, which had very heavy fighting just today. There are a number of cities that are not really under the control of the central government, and the effort in Najaf appears to be an effort to try and choke off this movement with a very symbolic victory in a place that is revered by many Shiites.
But a symbolic victory could also wind up being an extremely dangerous one if the shrine itself is attacked or damaged, no?
Well, this is the danger all along, and this is what a lot of analysts are saying. They don't actually see a win scenario for either the government or the Americans in this one. If they do attack the shrine and crush the rebellion, now mind you that there were no fighters that we saw when we went into the shrine itself. We did see fighters around the shrine, but not inside of it. If the shrine is attacked, many Shiites will see this as an affront to their own religion, even if they are not supportive of Muqtada al-Sadr. If they do kill Muqtada al-Sadr, which is another possibility here, then you risk turning him into a martyr. If you are able to negotiate a settlement and Muqtadir al-Sadr walks away alive, maybe relocates to Kufa, where his real base is, then he still looks like he's winning. It's very difficult to see how the Iraqi government comes out on top on this one.
Just one more for you, Scott, and that is about al-Sadr himself. I understand that the man has not been seen in public in over a week. Is that right?
That's correct. The last time he was publicly seen was for the Friday prayers a little over a week ago. His hand was bandaged. We had had reports that he had been injured slightly in the fighting. That some shrapnel had struck him in three places. But since that time, he has remained out of sight. Some speculate that he's inside the shrine. Others think that he's in a safe house in the old city. But frankly, nobody really knows.
Scott, thanks for being with us. Take care of yourself.
My pleasure.
Scott Baldoff is correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. Joining us now from the WMUB studio in Oxford, Ohio, Adid Dawisha. He is a professor of political science at Miami University in Oxford and former senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. Adid, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, Hassan Nemne. He's director of documentation of the Memory Foundation. It's an organization out of Baghdad which is keeping track of Iraq's history of abuse. Hello, Hassan.
Good morning.
You are most recently back from Baghdad, what, about a week ago, is that right?
Correct.
At that time, did you find that the uprising in Najaf, the fighting in Sadr City that Scott's been describing, are battles that are captivating Iraqis? Are people able to talk about rebuilding the country, doing the things that we've long heard about, or are people completely consumed by what's going on with this al-Sadr man?
Actually, it's clearly the latter rather than the former. I mean, what the general feeling in Baghdad is that there is indeed an atmosphere of war, and the concern is to see how this war is unfolding. It is the war in question is multi-layered, meaning people realize that indeed Sadr is not a puppet of anyone, meaning he's not a puppet of the Iranian government, for example, but nonetheless they do see it as a conflict between two projects. One is a project of construction, however flawed, however problematic, however actually even in terms of the people engaged in it, however questionable. I'm talking about the project represented by the government of Ayad Alawi. The other is the project of negation, a project not necessarily of destruction, but at least with no clear platform. And therefore, there is indeed a tension. Emotionally, many people are supportive of Sadr and of his movement, but at the more, if you'd like, sober level, I mean, they do realize that nothing is offered at that end. And therefore, there's a sense of not necessarily desperation, but a sense of a negative sense in the air, a negative atmosphere, I would say, towards what's going on.
It is very clear that the Shiites have suffered for the past 10, 15 years, perhaps more than any other group in Iraq, and we're talking about the majority of the population. That much all of us know. This idea that Iran now somehow has a hand, hidden or otherwise, in keeping this uprising going. Can you give us a sort of simple explanation as to why that would be in the Iranian interest?
Well, again, here we're talking about convergence of interests rather than manipulation, rather than, if you'd like, simply the Iranian government calling the shots. But the point of view in question goes as follows. Any stability in Iraq, any success in Iraq, is by necessity detrimental to the interests of the Iranian government. If this, in the best case scenario, from the point of view of the Iranian government, if this stability is through a regime, through a government in Iraq that is sympathetic, that is, let's say, friendly towards Iran, nonetheless, this new government, the new Iraqi government, will present a platform for Iranian opposition. Here we're talking about a relationship between the two countries that is beyond the one that you'd expect from neighbors. This is an organic relation on a yearly basis, literally millions.
So any stability, any kind of democratic success in Iraq is
yes,
by its nature, a threat to what?
A threat,
to Iran.
Because we're talking about millions of pilgrims crossing from Iran to Iraq on a yearly basis. They are bound to see an alternative to the Iranian system, and therefore there is a danger in there. But this is the benign scenario. A more problematic scenario would be Iraq as an ally of the U.S. serving as a base for an active destabilization of the Iranian government, and this is another problem. So, I mean, there seems to be an opinion that considers that stability can only happen either in Iraq or in Iran, but not in both.
Okay, Adin Dawisha, maybe I can just ask you to come in on this one. Your opinion on the idea that Iran has a definite hand in what's going on in Najaf, particularly because it's such an important Shiite shrine.
I think on many points I agree with Mr. Nemne. The thing that I want to caution is people going out with the opinion that somehow Muqtada Sadr is a puppet in the hand of the Iranians. But if we're talking about convergence of interest, there is no doubt in my mind that this is absolutely true. It is in the interest of Iran to have Iraq destabilize. It's in the interest of Iran to encourage a cleric who calls for an Islamic government and belittles the notion of democracy as a Western concept.
Mm-hmm. But you're saying that Muqtada al-Sadr, the young cleric in Iraq, is not a puppet of Iran, despite the fact that he has these close links with Ayatollahs in Iran?
This would be my reading of the situation. I don't think he's a man who basically sits around in Najaf waiting for instructions to come from Tehran. But there is no doubt in his own mind that Iran is a very close and a very strong ally if he is to take on the government of Iyad Alawi. And it is in his interest to, in a sense, if not advertise, at least hint at the fact to actually make his case even stronger and, in a way, kind of undermine the confidence of the government. It's one thing for Iyad Alawi and the Americans to take on Muqtada Sadr, but it's another if they know that he is backed logistically, politically, diplomatically, or even in terms of security by Iran. It's in the interest of both to create this image that somehow there is a very close, almost symbiotic relationship between Muqtada Sadr and the Iranians. Now, what actually is happening in real terms? How is this convergence of interest being translated into policies? I myself am not very clear.
Hassan, we have just a few seconds before we go to a break. But when you look at what that link is, are we talking about money, political support, or something more passive that Adid's talking about?
If we are to believe reports that are circulating in government circles in Iraq, well, the link is beyond the moral support. The link seems to be at least in the tacit approval of crossing of fighters who are joining Muqtada Sadr's movement, not necessarily in Najaf, mind you, but elsewhere. An example would be Hella, where at one point when I was there, there was a report of busloads of people who presumably are pilgrims, but actually are all young men who potentially have participated in what has gone in Hella. I mean, again,
all
these
right.
are not confirmed, but this is what government circles are talking about.
I understand. 1-800-423-8255. That's the number for you to join our conversation this hour as we try to understand what's going on with the continued insurgency in Najaf. For 10 years, Iran and Iraq fought a fierce war in the 1980s. Is it possible that the fight that is underway in that eastern part of Iraq right now is in fact the first battle in a resumption of that war? And what would the implications be? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. The number to join our conversation this hour, 1-800-423-TALK. And we're taking a look once again at what's going on in Najaf. Fierce fighting over the weekend and again last night with the U.S. soldiers attacking positions held by the Mehdi army around the Imam Ali shrine there, though a continued reluctance to get too close or to let the firing get too close to the soldiers who are in and around that area of the shrine. We're taking asking you and our guests this hour to speculate on the involvement of Iran in this particular fight. It certainly is in Iran's interest, as both Hassan Nemne and Adid Dawisha have pointed out, to have continued chaos in Iraq. But is that an active role they're playing or more of a passive one? I'm going to take our first call from Worcester, Massachusetts. Paul is with us. Hi, Paul.
Yes, hi.
What do you think?
Hello. Yes. Well, I'm an Iranian and I'm a Shia Muslim, and I go to Iran every year, you know, to visit family. And I can tell you that, you know, Iran is masterminding, you know, this whole chaos in Najaf. As a Shia, I believe in Ali and I respect Ali, you know, but the Iranian government is a terrorist government. And the reason they're causing this chaos and the reason they're supporting what's going on right now in Najaf is because they know they're next. After Saddam, they're going to be next, and the U.S. is going to kick them out of that country, and it's about time. Because for the past, since 1978, since Khomeini took over the Iranian, took over the government in Iran, the Middle East has not been the same. I do blame the Americans for it. I do believe the...
Paul, let me interrupt you and ask you a question, though. Why is it in the interest of the Iranians to keep Iraq on edge right now? I understand what you're saying about their fear that their country could be the next one attacked in much the same way that Iraq was attacked.
No. U.S. has nothing against Iranian people. U.S. doesn't like that Iranian government, and the Iranian people don't want that government. And the reason that they are causing this chaos is because they want to keep the U.S. Government busy, you know, with this chaos, so they never get to, you know, to them. And sooner or later, you know, they won't be able to keep doing this, and they know that they have to go. You know, it's going to be time for them to, you know, to go. I mean, they've been there long enough, and they've caused the destruction of the whole Middle East.
Okay, Paul, let me just stop you there and bring Adi Dawisha in here, because although this has been mooted about for some months, Adi, there's still no real proof of any direct Iranian involvement, is there?
Well, as I said earlier, I personally have not been aware of any proof. I'm willing to believe that the Iranians are sending fighters in. And without doubt, my knowledge comes basically from watching the TV stations, listening to radio, and watching, of course, the Arabic satellite networks. And all I can say is that when I watch these interviews, they tend to be with Iraqis. I mean, I can immediately tell from the accent and from the dialect whether the person they're talking to is an Iraqi or not an Iraqi. Iranians who speak Arabic have a very definite accent. And all I can say is that for the last, not just 2 weeks, but for the last 4 or 5 months, whenever they've interviewed these fighters in Najaf, and sometimes in Karbala, mm-hmm. They tended to be Iraqis. Now, given that the main focus of the TV stations is on Najaf and to a lesser extent on Karbala, it may very well be that the fighting that we hear about, say in Basra or in Hilla or Diwani or any of these southern cities, this fighting does have an element of Iranians. But I really have no way of knowing. And beyond rumors and innuendos, yeah. I cannot tell you anymore. All I can say is that every time anyone of any fighter who has been interviewed and has appeared on TV, he has been speaking in an Iraqi accent and simply cannot be Iranian. But beyond that, I cannot say very much.
All right, Hassan, a word from you here. There is this. We keep coming back to this fact that there doesn't appear to be any smoking gun, any proof that Tehran is directly involved here.
Yes, but as I did mention, meaning that there has been a number of reports circulating contrary to that, and again, not in Najaf. So I do agree with what Adid was saying. I mean, monitoring the news does seem to suggest that all the fighters are Iraqis. And as a matter of fact, I mean, it's important to note the following. While we can speculate about the fact that there might be a second Iran-Iraq war taking place and with lines of attack, Muqtada Sadr being one, a political action being a second, maybe even the political parties that are allied to Iran being a third. Nonetheless, it's important to stress the fact that Muqtada Sadr does represent very much so a native movement, meaning the agency is not solely in Iran, if it were in Iran at all. It's important to underline the fact that Muqtada Sadr represents, if you like, the populism of the excluded. He is a product of generational issue, if you like. I mean, the Saddam regime ended up creating a whole underclass, and Muqtada Sadr represents it. I mean, in his parochialism, in his introverted way of reading Iraqi reality, meaning we cannot simply dismiss him as an Iranian creation.
Which is a way of saying here that the man is an Iraqi nationalist. He has those interests. If it happens to coincide with the interests of Tehran, that's a good thing, right?
Exactly. Here, what you're talking about, meaning there are two levels. There is indeed an Iraqi civil war taking place today between a reconstituting government that's trying to centralize, that's trying, in a certain sense, to recreate the administrative structures of what was before, and a populist movement that is a product of what was before, but nonetheless is rejecting it. So we do have an internal Iraqi clash, an internal Iraqi civil war, if we may use the word, but that does not exclude that there's, on top of that, there's another layer in which basically the another party, which is Iran, has distinct interest and is trying to, if you'd like, organize that civil war in such a way to ensure that its interests are protected.
All right, so back to our callers to Sherborne, Massachusetts. Chuck's with us. Hi, Chuck.
Yes, I have two news items that I've seen over the last few weeks from pretty reliable sources. One of them is that another factor that has to be taken into consideration is the Sunni triangle. Some reporters have witnessed some Sunni military people, militia, I guess, training people in from Najaf. So that's a significant development, because that's the one thing the Pentagon and Bush has been very afraid of, is that those two would unify. The second thing is, I saw a news item in the Asian Times, actually, which usually proves to be pretty reliable, that the Iranians are not only giving to the Shiites, but to all parties involved, so that no matter who wins, they will be they'll have influence there. And just a comment on it.
Are you suggesting then, Chuck, that to point a finger directly at Iran is to simplify it a bit too much?
I think so. And one has to wonder, you know, what the significance of this is. Would there be chaos without Iran? Of course there would. And what about the Israelis? And nobody's saying much about the Israeli presence up in the north. And, you know, all the countries can be expected to jump in.
Let me, if I can, Chuck, start where you began with this working together of the Sunni insurgents in the Sunni Triangle and the young men from Najaf. I did not see that same report, but Hassan Nemne, that in a way illustrates what you're talking about, the idea of an Iraq civil war where you have people of different philosophical interests, more so than religious interests, battling each other.
Actually, again, anecdotally, I can mention the following. People in Sadr City mentioned to me at one point the fact that fighters in Sadr City, supporters of Muqtada Sadr, seem to have weapons and to be able to use those weapons, meaning so to have people who can use those weapons in ways that they, knowing them, meaning knowing those fighters, could not be doing it on their own. I mean, they kept on saying that, meaning they see a connection with Fallujah. Now, putting aside all the conspiracy theories that can circulate, nonetheless, we do see here the emergence of, if you'd like, common goals for the multiple insurgencies, and even the so-called Sunni insurgency is not one, is multiple in itself, mm-hmm. meaning you have Islamist jihadist on the one hand, you have Ba'athist on the other hand, you have national Islamic as the core of it. So there seems to be, again, further convergence in here between the various insurgencies, including that of Muqtada Sadr. We are talking about two projects, but as I mentioned before, one of them, the government project, seems to be one of construction, while the opposition, which is now insurgency, it's not resistance because it is not formulating itself as such, does not seem to have something concrete to offer.
So, Adid Dawisha, if we put the idea of an Iraq civil war template over what we understand happening in Iraq right now, is it reasonable in your view to say, okay, you have the Islamists and the jihadists on one side and the Ba'athists and the others who are more secular on the other side?
Well, as far as the Sunnis and Shiites are concerned, let me just make this point. Up until Muqtada Sadr rose with his Mahdi army in April, the entire resistance to, at least the, not if not the entire, the bulk of the resistance to the Americans, and then, of course, certainly to the, at that time, the Iraqi Governing Council, came from this very small area of Iraq, which lies to the north and northwest of Baghdad, and which we now call the Sunni Triangle. And whenever I've been, I was asked about this, I kept mentioning the fact that the actual resistance to the Iraqi government and to the American occupation is very localized, both geographically and demographically. It is therefore not a surprise to me that the people in Fallujah and in Baquba and other of these Sunni towns are extremely delighted with the insurrection of the Mahdi army in Najaf, because it is the first time that a Shiite group, in fact, has risen against the status quo or the new political order. And therefore, it will come absolutely as no surprise to me that these guys in Fallujah, the jihadists or the Ba'athists for that matter, either of these two groups, are helping the Mahdi army, are helping certainly the elements in Sadr city, to which they have which is nearer the Sunni triangle.
Okay, Adid, I get a little bit confused here, though, because if it is in fact something for the Sunni fighters in Fallujah or the Sunni triangle to celebrate when they see this chaos in Najaf, what they are in fact celebrating is a confrontation to the interim government of Iyad Alawi. What they're celebrating is a continuation of chaos in Iraq. What's the end game? Where does it all end up for them?
You know, the end game is a power, it's a power game. Both parties think that left to their own devices, they are going to be the eventual winners. They will win the day. The Shiites and Muqtada Sadr depends on the notion that 60% of the Iraqi population is Shiite. And therefore, if he emerges as the leader of the Shiites because of his resistance to the Americans, and especially if he ends up winning either in reality or psychologically, in other words, even what is important here is not that he defeats the Americans, but what is important is that the people think that he has won the day. He thinks if he wins, then his popularity in the Shiite community will make all of the other competitors, all of the other grand ayatollahs marginalized, and he will emerge as the winner. The Sunnis, on the other hand, even though they know they're their minority, they think and they believe that if left to their own devices, if the Americans leave and there's a power vacuum, that even though the Shiites are a majority, it is they in the Sunni triangle, the backbone of Saddam's security apparatus, the backbone of Saddam's armed forces, where all of the training, where all of the equipment is, that even with their minority status, they can actually win the day. And therefore, at the moment, there is a convergence of interest between Muqtada Sadr and the Fallujah crowd, as I'd like to call them.
All right, and all of it putting the screws eventually on Iyad Alawi, the interim prime minister. I wonder if I can keep our callers involved here. We're going to Greensboro, North Carolina next, and Juan is on the line. Hi, Juan.
Hi. I think we're forgetting that there's an enlightened self-interest with people who support the insurgencies. Iyad Alawi represents an alliance with American business interests to privatize things that would have been nationalized or locally owned, and it makes sense to oppose them economically.
And so the opposition that we're observing in Najaf, the fighting that took place in the Sunni Triangle, everybody's working towards the same end, eventually, of keeping American hooks out of the country's economy. Is that what you're saying, Juan?
Yeah, I think you should check out an article in Harper's about that. I think it's Iraq Year Zero.
Actually, this is why I refer to part of Muqtada Sadr's movement as the populism of the excluded. The excluded here are not only the excluded politically and socially, if you'd like, over the decades of totalitarian rule by Saddam, but also the excluded economically from in the new Iraq. And this is where, basically, I tend to agree with the early assessment of the reporter back in Najaf, that this is almost a guaranteed lose-lose situation from an American and Iyad Alawi point of view. Because dealing with the Muqtada al-Sadr phenomenon is today, it's almost too late. I mean, dealing with it should have started long ago, meaning we had more than a year to deal with it. And the dealing in question is not military squashing it or anything, but trying to take away the base of support that this movement has. And it is indeed in Sadr City. It is indeed in the south, where basically the masses, I mean, the large segments of the population, especially the younger generations, those who have known nothing but Saddam, basically.
But Hassan, they've tried. It's just that they've tried always in a tentative way. It was months ago when they closed down Muqtada al-Sadr's newspaper and began with that action, the first real fighting in Sadr City.
That was a stick as opposed to a carrot. What I'm suggesting, you know, in order to take away the base, it's not a question of shutting him down or not letting him speak. It's a question of really, I mean, in a sense, the Muqtada al-Sadr movement is an indication that so far, the New Iraq Project has not worked. At least it has not worked the way it was supposed to work, by providing opportunities for a large component of the population, meaning clearly people who have intrinsic interests, meaning have interest in what the previous regime had done, are going to do their best to try to foment trouble and to basically have the insurgency move on. But we cannot deny that there's a real component, a real socioeconomic reality, that many of those young men who are taking arms are responding to. And therefore, it is important, meaning in order to try to get out of the current situation, not simply to try to deal with Muqtada al-Sadr himself and the political threat that he constitutes, but to try to drain away the sources of his support by providing serious opportunities on the ground.
But Adid, very briefly here, because we have a break coming up, if you were to say to Muqtada al-Sadr, would you sooner have your face on a political poster or continue to be this sort of rebel commander? I mean, he's in the winning position now, isn't he?
That's my feeling, and that's why I disagree slightly on this question. I don't think Muqtada al-Sadr is really interested in the political process, or at least he's interested in the political process that he himself commands, and that will only happen if he believes that the people have perceived him as a winner, and that can only happen as a result of a fight with the Americans that projects him as a winner.
1-800-423-8255. And Connection listeners, what are the implications for the American army at this particular point? If it is a lose-lose situation to continue to confront Muqtada al-Sadr in Najaf, what are the options at this point? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me on the program this hour, Hassan Nemne, Director of Documentation of the Memory Foundation. It's a foundation which works to keep a record of Iraq's history of abuse. Professor Adid Dawisha is also with us. He teaches political science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. And Adid, I just want to ask you if you can complete the answer. I feel you were a little bit rushed just going into the break. How do you persuade someone like Muqtada al-Sadr that, in fact, a political solution is in his interest? If it looks to him like it's better to be a martyr or a martyred leader or a leader of martyrs, how do you convince someone like that that politics is, in fact, perhaps a better long-range goal for him?
It seems to me that it's going to be a very difficult exercise. The only way that you can convince somebody like Muqtada to participate in the political process is if you actually guarantee him, or if he himself feels as though it is guaranteed that he's going to emerge as the top dog amongst the Shiite community, which itself constitutes the majority of the Iraqi population. It seems to me that up until this moment, this has not been the point that one can convince him with. I mean, he feels, I think, that there is still a long way to go, that his popularity is spreading amongst the Shiite, but by the same token, and he can see that in Najaf, very close at home, there is a very large percentage of Shiites who actually dislike him. In fact, they despise him, and they think that he is, after all, the core problem in this conflict.
Too much of a popular. Too much of a carpetbagger, a man without the religious credentials that he boasts? Is that why they're critical of him?
The Shiites have traditionally, over centuries, been of the quietest tradition.
Right.
Almost most of the Shiite religious leaders, certainly in Iraq, have advocated separation of state and religion. And as a result of that, you find that the Grand Ayatollahs, particularly, for example, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, throughout the occupation, has never once advocated violence against the Americans. They've always, in fact, advocated peaceful resistance. And it seems to me, up until now, many Shiites would rather follow this kind of route than the one that Muqtada is following. And look, they're not idiots. It is Muqtada's people who are in the Sahan al-Sharif, the Imam Ali Mosque.
Right.
It is Muqtada's people who are actually lobbing mortar against the Americans. It is they who are inviting the possible destruction, or if not destruction, at least problems in the mosque. This cannot escape them. And so as a result of that, up until now, I wouldn't say that Muqtada Sadr has amassed enough following for him to be confident that if he goes into the political process, he'll emerge as a winner.
All right. We did begin the program by wondering or speculating on the involvement of Iran in the fighting that's underway in southeast Iraq today. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Boston. Dan's on the line. Hi, Dan. What do you think?
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The show. Actually, I think that al-Sadr sees any support from Iran as just a means to an end. I think the history is so raw in that region, and that the American support of the Shah in the past, and of course the revolution in '79, that right now that's still in the minds, I think, of a lot of the Shiites there, and that America, of course, support of Alawi right now is something that they are very nervous about. So I think that's why his support grows and why he's receiving support from the Ayatollah. I definitely think that's coming from Iran. But the one thing is, and I have a question as well, is that I'm wondering what the actual goal of the Ayatollah is. I mean, does he see any sort of possibility now of – I mean, it seems like al-Sadr is definitely looking to himself as the leader of this community, and that he ultimately would like to see himself as the leader of the Shiite state here. So what is the Ayatollah –
You mean the Ayatollah of Iran, Khamenei?
Yeah, Khamenei.
Yeah.
I mean, is Ayatollah Khamenei, does he think that he is actually going to, in his support, which I do think there is some, you know, what does he hope to gain in helping al-Sadr out? I mean, I just see that this his personality is so strong, and that he sees himself as a leader of this region here. And even if he is dead, the other thing is, even if he does actually get killed and become a martyr, I feel like someone else will just come to take his spot, and support will still continue from Iran.
Okay, let me stop you there if I can, Dan, and ask Hassan Nemne to help you out with what's in the interest of the Iranian clerical leadership, if in fact there is that support we've been speculating about.
Well, I mean, at best it can be a negative interest rather than a positive one. I mean, it's important to note that there's virtually no following for Khamenei as a marja, as a religious reference, if you'd like, in Iraq itself.
Right.
The four grand ayatollahs in Iraq, Ali Sistani is the most prominent of which, clearly do not include Khamenei or anyone for that matter in Iran. Even Kadhim Ha'iri, who used to be at one point the spiritual, if you'd like, guide of Muqtada Sadr, is now reported to have problems with the Muqtada Sadr, and the relation is not in any way tidy there. I mean, but it's important to note nonetheless that in the case of Iraq, Muqtada Sadr has two types of support. Let's call them deep support and shallow support. In terms of the deep support that he has, it's a very limited number of people who basically fit a certain profile, generational, socioeconomic, regional, etc. It is the shallow support that is much wider, and by shallow support I mean sympathy and support that is reactive to news items. And this is what he's trying to deepen, he's trying to widen.
And this is admiration for a man who is standing up to the Americans in part?
Partly, basically feeling that there is some justice in what he's doing. And this is the type of support that comes as a result of disappointment with the new Iraq project that has not delivered. Mm-hmm. So one major way of basically reducing Muqtada al-Sadr and diffusing the situation is to go after this type of support. And the way to do it is multifaceted. One is political, another is economic, but also religious. We would like very much so, meaning I would like very much so to see more of what Hussein al-Sadr, a cousin of Muqtada al-Sadr, has done. He's also a cleric. He has basically stood up and finally spoken against Muqtada, asking him to get out of the shrine. If more of this happens in the clerical institution on the part of the four grand ayatollahs and other prominent clerics in Iraq, the shallow support the wide shallow support that Muqtada currently has will recede, and faced with the reality that his base has really shrunken, Muqtada might actually have to decide to opt out of a confrontation. But
maybe to go the political route. Well, as, I mean, as an alternative.
He does not. I do not think he and people in his current, the so-called Tayyar al-Sadr, there is no real understanding of what the political interaction is. Meaning, these are really the heirs to Saddamism, to the Baathism that Saddam has created, which is basically they're imposing a reign of terror. I mean, we have to underline that both in Najaf, in Sadr City, and elsewhere. Punishments that used to be basically that people used to suffer as a result of insulting Saddam, people are today suffering as a result of showing disrespect to Muqtada.
And why wouldn't Muqtada al-Sadr have that point of view? His father was killed by Saddam Hussein. The man is 32 years old. The only leader he's ever known in Iraq is a man who ruled by brute force. In a way, it's the language he was weaned on, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And actually, it's important to deny him the ability to make that language the new political discourse of Iraq by basically providing alternatives. What has been missing, unfortunately, is exactly that somehow liberal, somehow open, somehow pluralistic mainstream of a discourse presented to the Iraqis in general, to Iraqi society. Unfortunately, this is another failure. Then when we look at the past year, we have to admit that the ex-Iraqi opposition was unable to reach out to the white public with such alternatives, and therefore Muqtada al-Sadr on the one hand and the other insurgencies on the other were able to capture quite a bit of sympathy. We have to admit it, although this is a sympathy that basically increases and decreases as a function of news elements.
Let me stop you if I can. We have a number of callers. We want to try and get to them before the end of the program, too. Everett, Massachusetts, and Moses is on the line. Hi, Moses.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me on. I have a comment. But before that, I just want to say that, you know, I'm not defending any government or any religious organization. But for me, there is a confusing, you know, point that American from here went to Iraq, overthrown Saddam for their own national interest. Now, why the Iranian government shouldn't have any right to interfere in Iraqi's internal affair?
Moses, are you Iranian?
Yes, I am Iranian.
So you're saying, you know, if the USA can say it's in our interest to go and squash Saddam Hussein, who's to say that it's not in the interest of Tehran to take exactly the same policy now that Iraq is basically in flames?
Yeah, but before that, you know, I am the one that who suffered under the Saddam because I was in that war, Iran-Iraq war, and also suffered under the Iranian regime, their government and their actual, you know, mullahs who are there.
Okay, but Moses, what do you make of the point that has been expressed on this program that you can't really have a democratic Iraq that is not also a threat to Iran? And so if Iran is simply saying, let's cause more bloodshed in Iraq in order to preserve our own country, is that really a good enough reason to do it?
Yeah, but, you know, for me, you know, democratic government is different than, you know, the views that the Americans have. Democratic government that the American they want to have over there is a government that supports whatever the Americans say.
No, I don't want to get into a debate with you about a definition of American democracy. We'd spend the next 2 hours on that. But can there be Iran and Iraq coexisting side by side now that Saddam Hussein is no longer there?
Yeah, they can coexist if the other, you know, foreign government doesn't interfere in there. But, you know, my point was that, you know, to ask these gentlemen that why the Iranians shouldn't have any right to interfere in the Iraqis' affair, because, you know, there are rights next to them, and, you know...
I'm going to stop you there, Moses, simply to try and move things along. But Adid Dawisha, what about this? That you know, Tehran has self-interest. Why not express that?
Well, look, if there's interference in interference, if it's couched in constructive terms, then that's fine. If the Iranians are sending volunteers to the southern part of Iraq, building roads, bringing food, you know, that is the way you want to improve your image and certainly heighten your interest in Iraq. If, on the other hand, what they're doing is supporting a man who basically leading an insurrection against an order that is leading to democracy. You can be against Iyad Alawi, but Iyad Alawi is heading an interim government. We're looking forward to elections in January, and then again to writing of the constitutions, referendum on the constitution around August of 2005, and a final election in December 2005. Mm-hmm. For this to happen, we need to have a semblance of security. And if the man who is being egged on and helped in whatever means possible by the Iranians is actually becoming an impediment to this process, then Iran is interfering in a very destructive rather than a constructive way. And I can't see that, in a sense, the end result is going to in any way serve Iranian interest in the long term.
Okay, but Hassan, are we ever going to get to those elections? Is the timetable itself not already in tatters as we look at what's going on? I need you to be brief because we're close to the end of the program.
We have serious problems in that respect. I mean, the National Conference was unfortunately not a total success, meaning in form it went along, but in content, I mean, major questions have been raised, meaning we have to be extremely careful about how this timetable unfolds, meaning it is important for us to not only have, if you'd like, a process that gives us something that we can claim is democratic, but something that would end up being effectively, in essence and in content, democratic.
Hassan, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Hassan Nemneh is Director of Documentation of the Memory Foundation, based in Baghdad. And Adid Dawisha, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Adid is a professor of political science at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Earlier in the program, we talked with Scott Baldoff, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He joined us from Sadr City. The Connection is produced by Nancy Cohen, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugertz. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.